From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we start the program with some more Alternatives Journal fare. We are joined by Chelsea Gutsman, who wrote an article for Alternatives Journal earlier in July with regards to the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Interesting perspective of the article, though, is that she got the views of some ecotourism locales that will be affected by the proposed pipeline. So kind of revisiting ecotourism there a little bit, but with a bit of a new twist and some more updated information on Northern Gateway. And then later in the program, a bit of an unexpected interview, but I was recently walking in for, I'll admit it, I did eat a hamburger. I'm sorry, Leah. I was there just noticing that I was in a particular burger place, and not just were they kind of pointing out some of their sustainability initiatives, but I noticed that it was extremely prominent, and so that really caught my eye that a corporate business was so sure of their sustainability being a positive for their business that they really had gone way out of their way to make it front and center for the customer. So we'll actually be speaking to Warren Price, Executive Vice President of South Street Burger Co. and New York Fries later in the program to ask him why he's so sure that sustainability is a selling point for their company. All this and more is coming up, of course, but for now we're joined by Leah Mazzolini with our international headlines, or national?
National right
We're
now.
Starting with national today. We're going to mix it up this week. Go ahead, Leah.
Thanks, Darren. The federal government is working on new greenhouse gas emission standards for post-2016 car models. The new regulations are intended to harmonize Canada's legislation with that of the United States, announced on Tuesday, August 28th. Ottawa's new rules will force automakers to significantly improve fuel efficiency in their vehicles, with the goal being an 80% mileage improvement by 2025 as compared to today's standards. Details are still in development, but a spokesman from Environment Minister Peter Kent announced on Wednesday that the intent is to make standards similar on both sides of the border. The Obama administration's plan would make the corporate average fuel economy standard rise to 54.5 miles per gallon in 2025. In Canada, this would be the equivalent to improving fuel efficiency to 4.4 liters per 100 kilometers, lowering it from the current 6.6. A PhD student from York University, Chris Luzziak, says that he was studying in the Iqaluit's Airport Creek and came to a serious conclusion. His insect and water samples revealed significant increases in certain nutrients such as nitrogen that are likely caused by the neighboring human activity. Nitrogen could be attributed to the nearby greenhouse and higher levels of iron and copper, which could result from leaching occurred from the dump site close by. Normally, Airport Creek would see about 20 to 30 species of insects, but according to Luzziak, the population of pollution-tolerant bugs is booming. This could easily affect the diet of the fish, causing toxins to travel up the food chain unless action is taken. The researchers from the Nunavut Research Institute and York hope to use the groundbreaking information on their water conditions to encourage community-based water monitoring around the territory. The Conservative government announced the cancellation of almost 600 environmental assessment projects in Ontario and almost 3,000 nationwide on Wednesday, August 29th. The list includes a diverse array of cancelled assessments, from decommissioning a plutonium recovery laboratory and constructing a nuclear fueled storage facility, to flood protection plans for the Don River. Peter Tabins of the Ontario NDP MP, an environment critic, referred to the decision as a downloading of responsibility, citing concerns that projects will fall through the gaps and be improperly assessed. According to the Ontario Environment Minister, Jim Bradley, the province was not consulted with regards to these changes and has sent correspondence to the Conservatives to protest. Environment Minister Peter Kent, however, disagrees with the supposed weakening of Canada's environmental protection regime. In a written statement on Tuesday, August 28th, he says where projects take place on federal land, The federal department is still required to ensure there are no significant adverse environmental effects. Kent also claims the cancellation of assessments amounts only to a difference in the amount of paperwork. A $2 million development complex in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia, for seniors will rely entirely on sustainable energy. The development, modeled to resemble the early 20th century row houses of historical coal mining town, will be powered by geothermal heat, solar, and wind energy. Excess energy from the project will be sold back to Nova Scotia Power. According to the developer, Luciano Lisi, residents will benefit as well since energy costs for the units will remain constant. The first sustainable units will be ready by as early as this October. And that's all for the national news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
That's very interesting, Leah, as well, just that tone that Peter Kent took. I wonder if the next time, you know, I get pulled over for something, or perhaps I get caught committing a crime in the future, I can say, you know, you really could arrest me, but it's just going to cause all this paperwork. We'll just skip the whole thing, I think. Anyway, we're going to be back in just a minute with our interview, Alternatives Journal, on the Northern Gateway Pipeline with Chelsea Gutzman. However, we'll be right back after this music break. Stay tuned.
Watch it.
And welcome back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, or one of our wonderful syndicates across the country. We're going to go now to an interview I recorded earlier this week. This is with Chelsea Gutzman with Alternatives Journal, and she takes a rather interesting and unique perspective on the Northern Gateway Pipeline project from the point of view of ecotourism and the effect on locals in BC. Go away. So I'm speaking to Chelsea Gutzman. She was submitted an article to our good friends over at Alternative Journal talking about Northern Gateway, and I've got her on the line now, who's apparently calling me from the middle of a marsh. Welcome to the Green Majority, Chelsea.
Thank you. I'm actually in the middle of Castalia Marsh Resort on Grand Manan Island, so it's great to be talking to you.
And so tell us a little bit about, you've got, we were talking before and you said you're not the most obvious environmentalist. You're coming at this more of a journalist, I guess, if anything. Do you want to just mention a little bit how you got onto this topic at all before we get into the nitty gritty of your article?
Sure. So I applied to work at Alternatives Journal just because I was interested in environmental issues, never having studied them before. And they accepted me for a work term, which was great. So I was working there for four months full time. And Eric, the editor there, just really believed in me and had this idea for this article that he really wanted to get done. And so he gave it to me, and I was a little hesitant at first, but I really got into it. You know, I was working on it for a good couple months, so I'm really happy with it.
Okay, and the outline of the article itself, we're talking about the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Obviously, that's been a big environmental issue in Canada for a while. Lots of government sources and others very excited about it, and pretty much unanimously every environmentalist pulling their hair out about it. So, but you took the angle of talking to some ecotourism locales here. So we've got four, you were able to contact, four owners and then one more owner of a, was it a resort or something, who basically said, I support the pipeline, but I refuse any further comment.
Yeah, it was actually a rafting company, but yeah.
So basically, I mean, the total article here was, we're talking about the pipeline and talking about the effects, but what I thought was really interesting about the story, because we've covered this issue, I mean, a dozen times or more, was just the perspective of kind of local businesses on the ground that are going to be affected by this. So why don't you just take us through a little bit some of the different people that you spoke to and some of the items that they had to say. Why don't we start with the King Pacific Lodge?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I spoke to Michael Uehara. He was the first person that I actually spoke with, and he has obviously been very involved in the debate, and he knows a lot about what's going on in that territory. He's been there for, I don't even remember, but a good number of years, and so he knows a lot about the whales, like the migration routes of the whales and the feeding areas of the whales, and he really knew a lot about how the tankers might affect the whales and other sea life. So that's what I talked to him mostly about. But yeah, he thinks that with super tankers going through there like twice a day, it's just really going to destroy the business and really destroy the pristine environment.
Have you seen this area?
Yeah, Hartley Bay. No, I haven't personally seen it myself. I've Pacific Wild, Ian McAllister, who I spoke with, has been making a lot of really great documentaries about the area, so that's kind of where I know the area from. But yeah, I'd love to go there at some point before it gets, you know, ruined.
And so, I mean, we'll keep going with some of the other lodges and stuff. But I'm sort of getting the sense from you already that you think this is a moot point potentially.
Yeah. Well, I just think the whole pipeline and the whole tankers going through the tanker traffic, I just think that it's a huge mistake. And I think, you know, in 50 years, if this were to go through, we're going to look back on it and we're going to look at it as one of the largest mistakes we've ever made.
Wow. And so was this the tone generally, like when you're speaking to Michael, for instance, was this the viewpoint that generally the people you were speaking to felt as well? They sort of reluctantly had to admit that the more than likely they weren't going to be able to stop the project.
I don't know. There's a lot of kind of grassroots kind of opposition to the pipeline. So people are thinking that this joint review panel process is kind of a waste of time. That was kind of the feeling that I was getting from a lot of the people I was speaking with. But everyone seems to agree that, you know, even if this does get pushed through, everyone's going to be there on the ground, you know, physically with blockades and things, because this is so important to so many people living out there.
One of the other perspectives, obviously, on this, aside from small business and the environmental community, is, of course, the First Nations community. One of the other owners, Marvin Robson, I'm not sure I know how to pronounce that, but the Gitgatak Spirit Tours?
It's the Gitgat Spirit
Tours. Gitgat Spirit Tours. Yeah. And so that kind of adds like another layer of perspective. Do you want to talk a little bit about their point of view on what exactly the impact here and their concerns were?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first spoke with him, I was first asking him about how he thinks it's going to affect, you know, his tourism and the people coming in and like his well-being as far as like tourism income goes. And he just really was not concerned about that at all. You know, being a member of First Nations right there on the tanker route, he is just really more concerned about his community and about their food source and about, you know, the bears and the wolves and the fish and the kelp and everything there that really sustains the whole area. So he really could not stress enough how little it meant to him that he would be losing tourism dollars and just how much it meant to him that it meant that possibly the whole community, you know, if there were to be a spill, the whole community would probably just have to move.
Yeah. I mean, he was saying in the, you were saying that he was identified in the article that they had a biologist that had been doing work on some of the tides and currents and talking about the, just the food chain there, about how, so like smaller fish feeding the herring, I think he was saying, feeding the salmon, and that feeds all the bears and when eventually gets up to, you know, feeding whales and this sort of thing. So, I mean, the impact here that seems to be that he's sort of identifying is that this could sort of, you know, like desertify as far as from a wildlife perspective anyway, the whole region.
Exactly. It's a really special area in terms of the herring being able to, you know, populate there. And without the herring, I mean, without the herring, there's no salmon. And without the salmon, there's no bears, no wolves. Like, it could potentially just totally devastate the entire area were we to lose that herring population.
Well, and the you know, BC salmon approached and marketed and has a similar impact, although not quite as vital, not as such a linchpin, but very reminiscent of the kind of cod on the East Coast as well. But are you aware of it all? Any concern one way or the other as far as how the BC provincial government feels about this? I mean, one would think that they'd be terribly concerned about what would otherwise be one of their largest kind of identifying trades.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as far as I can tell, they don't seem to be very much concerned at all. I mean, with the whole Cohen Commission thing that just happened, I mean, they're obviously not very concerned about the salmon populations or protecting them at all, as far as I can see, and I think that's a huge mistake. I think that they're being very short-sighted.
So then move on to Castan Outdoor Adventure Tourism. Kayla Pollard was the person that you spoke to there, and this is the one, I believe, where they do like horse rides and stuff like that, and like tours. There's been mostly tourism that they do. And they had identified some concern and pointed out some details that I thought were very interesting about how a lot of the intersections there is all going to be controlled by automated computer systems, and there's not live people on the ground kind of anywhere even nearby, specifically pointing out that if it happened during the winter months that they wouldn't be able to clean it up at all potentially, and during the summer even then it would still take people several days to even get on the ground assessing the spill. I mean, this sort of details that, you know, we start thinking about Deepwater Horizon and stuff like that and be like, is no one paying attention to how badly this goes? It seems like no one's learning from their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
it's just so isolated. Like, Fort St. James is one of the only towns even up there. So were there to be a spill like anywhere outside of like directly in Fort St. James, like potentially they could not discover the spill for, well, you know, the Kalamazoo River spill they didn't discover for 17 days or something like that. I mean, something like that could just ruin the whole water system. Like, it could get into Stewart Lake and it would just totally devastate the entire area, and they wouldn't even be able to get in potentially to clean it up. Some of the places that they're putting this pipeline through are just so remote. There's just no roads, no access at all. And in the winter, if it was stormy or anything like that, like, I could see the spill potentially going on for weeks.
Do you know at all, is it within what you've looked at or what you've learned about at all from any of the interviews that you did, as far as like what plans, if any, that Enbridge is saying that they would have in such a case? I mean, is there, as far as you know, is their assertion simply there will not be a spill, so don't worry about it, or?
Well, they do have some plans in place. I say that kind of loosely. When Kyla Pollard, she's really involved in the joint review panel process, and she's an intervener, and a lot of people in Fort St. James are. And when she was asking for information about their plans and everything like that for if there were potentially to be a spill, like, she found that they didn't really provide any specific information at all. Like, they had no plans for a specific, you know, location that would be closest for them to get to the spill. Like, they had no specifics at all. It was all very general and, you know, not particularly helpful at all.
It reminds me, again, kind of going back to the Deepwater Horizon issue from a couple years ago, where they said, we're confident that we can, and then they said kind of under their breath, confront 90% of the oil. And it's like, so what does that exactly mean? Is it, what appears to literally mean in that case when they were saying with relation to building, you know, moving Arctic drilling and stuff like that and moving oil through the Arctic, was that, well, we'll go out in a boat and we'll point at, we'll be able to physically see with our own eyes that at least 90% of the oil. Seemed to be the response, and I'm getting sort of a very similar sort of thing here about, is like, just don't worry about it, it'll be fine. Cough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, am I being too sarcastic here, or does that really, like, is there really not any information that's been passed on about security and safety measures and that sort of thing?
Well, as of when I last looked at all of the papers and all of the information that has been submitted to the Joint Review Panel, which, by the way, is just absolutely overwhelming, and I think that is kind of the point, so that normal citizens can't even really sift through it at all. But the last time I looked, there were no specifics at all, and as far as everyone who I've spoken to, they have not been given any specifics at all. And, like, they're not even dealing with oil. Like, they're dealing with diluted bitumen, and there haven't been any tests at all to see how diluted bitumen would react differently if it were spilled into water. Like, they're just operating under the assumption that this mixture is going to be acting the same as oil, but that there's been no studies and no confirmation of that whatsoever. And a lot of people are speculating that the condensate that it's going to be diluted with is just going to evaporate, and the bitumen is just going to sink so much quicker than normal oil, and it's just going to be impossible to clean up from the waterways.
I mean, we've been speaking quite a bit on the last couple of weeks about C-38 and about changing of environmental assessment rules, and just seems like that's the kind of tone right now, is proceed at any cost. And it sounds like that's definitely the impression that you got from the people that you were speaking to, and from what you've looked into as well here, is that there doesn't at least appear to have been too much even investigating. It's not even that, you know, they're hiding the information or something. It's that it doesn't even seem anyone's looked into it, and they're just kind of, oh, whatever, it'll be fine.
Exactly.
Is that the sort of impression that you've been getting?
Yes, exactly. Like, it seems like they are just assuming that this pipeline is just going to be just like any other pipeline, but it's really not. Just the area it's going through, the products that are going to be traveling through it, it's just a totally different ball game than anything they've done before. And they're just not doing the proper studies and the proper environmental assessments, and it just hasn't been done, and they just really have no clue.
Well, and I mean, it's to say that, you know, to assume that this is like any other pipeline, also sort of, you know, as a reminder, even regular pipelines aren't really that safe. Anyway, we have spills all the time, and, you know, without even getting into the complicated issue of people intentionally disrupting, you know, pipelines through mm-hmm. protest or terrorism or whatever it is that you want to call it. I mean, there's so many things that can happen, and so, I mean, you can't even really say that a regular pipeline is that safe, and this seems potentially much worse. I mean, we can't know for sure, but this is an area where you'd think you'd want at least some level of certainty or some, you know, safety bars, because we've got, you know, basically from what you're describing, it sounds like basically an untested situation in an extreme condition for that untested situation, no matter where it was, and in a particularly sensitive place if something does go wrong. I mean, it's from the way that you're describing it, and from what I've read elsewhere as well, I mean, it really sounds like playing with fire.
Precisely.
So there was one other owner that you interviewed as well, which is Timberwood Tours, and they said that part of their outlook as well is dealing a lot with kind of passing on stewardship, and their concern, a lot of it had to do with the fact that people from international tourism and stuff like that are losing interest in coming and looking at Canada, because like, why would we want to come and look at your pipeline?
Yeah, exactly. Like, when I was speaking with Mike, he was just mostly concerned about, because he gets a lot of tourists coming from France, Germany, and England and places like that, and he was just mostly concerned that people are just not wanting to come to Canada anymore because of, you know, because of the Harper government, the decisions they've been making, and, well, it goes back further than that, really, but it's just because everyone used to think of Canada as a pristine place. And it's just really, with the whole tar sands thing that's been going on, it's just really looking to other countries like we have lost that. Like, we have lost that sense of nature, and we've lost that sense of trying to protect our environment, and people just are not really wanting to come in as large numbers as they used to. And I was actually looking at a lot of tourism numbers. I was trying to get a chart into the article that I didn't end up getting in. But just the tourism rates, just from every other country, mm-hmm. is coming to Alberta and BC, like, they have just been declining over the past 10 years, like, almost unanimously, like, almost across the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the final quote from Mike as well was at the end was, why not invest all this energy and oil into finding alternatives for oil rather than digging up more? I don't suppose you have an answer to that question.
Why not? Money is the answer to that question, it's just, like, I really can't wrap my head around it. Like, I've spent a lot of sleepless nights just worrying about this, because it's something that is really important to a lot of Canadians, but is not important to our government that we elected. And I don't want to get too political or too passionate about it, so I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think it would be appropriate to say as well, I mean, it's one of those situations where, I mean, you know, we've covered over 100 projects on the Green Majority about different this and this and that, and there's you know, always somebody who's concerned about the local impacts, and we'll go and we'll talk to them. And you know what, sometimes, you know, it is a dangerous project and you know, nothing happens, or there is no, you know, super immediate effects, or we haven't noticed anything yet, but maybe it'll happen in the future. But the point, you know, isn't that every time something goes wrong, it's that, you know, calculating risk. And it just seems like, to me at least, from you know, reading through news articles every week, that the amount of risk that the government and corporations are willing to take, because I guess because they feel like it's on the public's back if anything goes wrong, just seems to be, like, the amount of risk they're willing to accept seems to be increasing over time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just like Christy Clark, Premier of BC, was saying, like, she doesn't think that the risk is worth the economic benefits, at least for BC. And everyone else that I was speaking to seems to think that money is just not an issue. You know, like, the Harper government keeps trying to buy off, you know, these groups, and thinking that eventually, like, people are going to come to their senses, per se, because of the jobs and the economic impact. But the thing is, it's not about money if we're not going to have a BC coast to pass on, you know, to our children. It's more important that we're able to pass on the land, you know, the BC coast and everything, than it is for any potential economic benefits that we could possibly get, because the risk is just way too high. Like, for the next 50 or 100 or even 300 years, our whole coast, or specific rivers, or, you know, the whole spirit bear population or whatever, can be totally wiped out, and that's really not worth anything. The joint review panel is going to be assessing until April, and then they're going to be presenting their findings, yeah, by the end of next year. So by the end of 2013, we're going to hopefully find out what the status of this project is, and hopefully it will be that it is not going through.
All right, that was Chelsea Gutsman from Alternatives Journal talking about the Northern Gateway Pipeline from the perspective of ecotourism locales in local BC, where she is currently right now enjoying a vacation in the middle of a swamp, I understand. We'll be speaking to Warren Price, who's the Executive Vice President of South Street Burger Co. and New York Fries, about some of their sustainability initiatives right after the break. However, we're going to just take another pause now to be rejoined by Leah Mazzolini for International Headlines.
Thanks, Darren. Arctic sea ice has been on the steady decline, but now scientists are warning that levels are dropping at the fastest rate ever. Researchers at the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center, or NSIDC, made the announcement on Monday, August 27th, that the record was observed for the month of August. This month, ice has been shrinking on average at about 100 square kilometers per day, which is twice as fast as normal. Also, the North Pole has melted to just over 4 million square kilometers, the smallest measurement since 1979. NSIDC research scientist Julian Strove says that the shrinking isn't quite finished yet. With about 3 weeks of melting left in the year, the North Pole is estimated to go down to below 4 million square kilometers. She adds that the previous record low set back in 2007 was made by ideal weather conditions. However, this year, there wasn't any meteorological factors that attributed to the new low, pointing at human-made climate change as a prime suspect. Oil major Royal Dutch Shell has been given the green light to start preparing to drill off the coast off the Alaskan coast. The Obama administration gave the okay to the preliminary work in the Chukchi Sea on Thursday, August 30th. However, the company can't tap areas containing oil until the government certifies its oil spill containment system, a safety feature below the seafloor related to the blowout prevention. The government was set to approve new drilling in Arctic waters earlier, but BP's massive 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico prompted a review of existing plans. Shell boasts that its new safety precautions and says that they can respond quickly to any problems, but environmental groups remain skeptical. Greenpeace director Danny Howell says that drilling in the sea is far too risky and the government should be investing in renewable energy rather than dirty fossil fuels. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the Arctic is estimated to contain 90 billion barrels of recoverable oil and over 1,600 trillion cubic feet of recoverable natural gas. Retail giant Walmart joins an alliance of other Fortune 500 companies seeking to make agriculture more sustainable. The Field to Market Alliance was created 3 years ago by nonprofit Keystone Center to improve agricultural productivity and to reduce the use of natural resources. It's also developing indicators to estimate environmental, economic, and social health and social outcomes and U.S. agriculture. In 2009, it launched its Field Print Calculator, a free online tool that helps growers analyze how their farming practices impact natural resources. The group's July 2012 report found that corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton, rice, and potatoes are being produced more sustainably in the U.S. than they were 30 years ago. Walmart says that its estimate 20 million metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions from its global supply chain by the end of 2015. However, only about 120,000 metric tons has been cut, according to its 2012 Global Responsibility Report. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
All right. Thank you very much, Leah. We're going to take a really quick music break here and come right back with Warren Price, Executive Vice President of South Street Burger, to talk about some of their sustainability initiatives. Stay tuned.
Just kill some time.
And welcome back. I'm Darren Kaster. This is The Green Majority. You can find us online at greenmajority.ca. Usually, however, as I've mentioned the past few weeks, we're still having an issue with our website. But stay tuned. We are working on it as quickly as we can. We are, in the meantime, still putting lots of content on our Twitter feed, which is at Green Majority, where you can get links to all sorts of environment stories that we consider for both Canadian and international for our headlines every week, far more than we actually do on the show. So it's a really good way to stay up to date. Also, stay tuned for our Pardon me, why am I saying stay tuned? It's been around for quite some time, and please continue to enjoy our Facebook fan page. I like to put lots of silly pictures and fun things up there as well, so you'll want to take part in. There's always an interesting discussion taking place on the Facebook page as well. We're also broadcasting on at least 17 campus and community stations in cities across the country, from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. You can listen live nationwide as well on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. You can also send us an email. If you want, you can ask me a question, suggest a news topic, anything you'd like. You might even just say hi or send us an email to say what a good job Leo or Rose are doing. That anything is appreciated. Anything is appreciated. You can even say that you don't like the show. That's fine. I'd prefer you didn't. But if you really feel like you need to, perhaps add some constructive criticism in there would be better than nothing. We're going to go now to our second interview for the day, and that's going to be Warren Price, Executive Vice President of South Street Burger Company and New York Fries. How are you doing today, Warren?
Very well. Thank you, Darren.
Thanks for taking the time to join us today. I'll just kind of give a little bit of backstory because it seems like a bit of an odd interview for us. But I was in one of your stores the other day and I did notice, you see a lot of green stuff these days, and we've covered many, many times topics of like greenwashing and how popular the idea of environmentalism. But it really caught my eye. It really did seem when I walked into your store, there was a big plaque on really nice looking a really nice looking plaque with like lighting on it, and it was right when you walk in the door, this big huge sign saying about how the store was at least partially powered by Bullfrog and Bullfrog Power, and how they had, and not only that saying that they had, but there was some detail about like what that actually meant, and providing some information, and there were some other environmental initiatives there as well. So perhaps we could just start, if you want to outline a few of those ideas, just tell us exactly what it is that your company is doing with sustainability.
Well, we're a long way from perfect. And we do things to try to make us feel good about the business or better about how we do business. Bullfrog is a big part of that. It's something that we can do. We can't avoid energy consumption. We can try and use it smartly, but obviously we're going to consume some energy, so we can give back in that way. But we make a lot of other steps, too. We are very proud of all but three of our restaurants have heat recovery exhaust systems. Kitchens obviously put out a lot of heat from the cooking equipment. Typically, that's just exhausted into the outside air. We have heat recovery systems on all but three of the restaurants that allow us to recapture that heat and warm the buildings in the cooling season. And because we're Canadian, that happens to be longer than the air conditioning season. We use air-cooled ice machines instead of water-cooled. They cost a little bit more than the water-cooled machine does, but it means that we're taking, again, not using something that's cheap in Canada, water, to cool the machine effectively, but paying a little bit more to get a machine that isn't wasting water that way. There's other initiatives that we do in terms of the stores, whether it's a low-flow toilet. We're proud of putting in LED bulbs into all of our stores. 80% of our lamps are lit with LEDs, and that's brought down our energy use in electrical terms considerably. One of our restaurants has a solar water heating system on the roof, and we carry it through to other aspects of the business. We buy all of our beef from one ranch in Alberta. It's grown without the use of hormones and antibiotics, but we're particularly proud of that farm. They reuse the bio waste from the herd to make energy. In fact, they power nearly half of the community closest to them. And are smart in the way that they use water to prevent runoff as they are looking after the herd. We use Canadian potatoes in almost all of our stores, almost all of the time. Most of them come from a family farm in New Brunswick. We use Ontario chicken. We try to make the choices that are similar to choices that we might make at home in making the right decisions to help our families along and walk with a somewhat gentler footprint.
So there's a couple kind of big key issues here that I really wanted to ask you about that I was curious about. One of them was from a bottom line perspective. I mean, there's several things there where you're saying you've purchased or decided to invest in a slightly more expensive technology because of its environmental impact. And then there's other ones like energy conservation that have kind of a net positive for your business, which is saving energy, which reduces cost.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested, I mean, obviously you're probably not going to have numbers sitting there right there in front of you, but in an abstract sort of sense, do you feel like overall that there's a net gain or a net loss for your bottom line from doing these initiatives when you combine them all together?
If you take out the feel-good aspect of doing the business this way, it probably comes at something of a cost.
Mm-hmm.
In a typical restaurant, we might have 200 bulbs. If we convert those 200 lamps to LEDs at $50 a bulb, then we've got a $10,000 light bulb cost the day we open the store. And if we're in traditional halogens or incandescents, we'd probably have a cost of under $1,000.
Wow.
And so that upfront cost is significant and can't be ignored. It does pay back. We do know we use less energy, but it takes a considerable investment to get you to the point where you're saving that energy, realizing that cost, and it's going to take a number of years to pay back. The heat recovery exhaust systems come at a nasty premium as well. They do bring our heating costs down. We can measure that. We're aware of it. We know that it's better in terms of carbon footprint, but it's about a 7-year payback. And by the time a restaurant's 7 years old, you're probably renovating the whole thing anyways. So it's not necessarily an economic benefit to the company, at least in terms of direct cost and expenses.
And I'd imagine in this sort of a case too. I mean, we're talking about. You guys are a corporation. You have stores all over the country, and I'm sure you're in the U.S. as well. And I'm not sure if you're outside of the U.S. and Canada. But I mean, this is something where you guys have some capital to sit on here, and you kind of have more, I guess, business assurity that your stores are going to be there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely something where it's been easier, I guess, in an abstract sense, for you guys to come around to do this sort of project rather than someone perhaps opening a local family business.
I think that's true. If I may, we are a Canadian company based here in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
New York Fries has stores all the way across the country. South Street Burger Company has locations in Alberta and Ontario. And we did open our first international South Street last week in Dubai. That notwithstanding, you're right. The investment is something that is easier for us to take on than it would be for a mom-and-pop operator. And that's unfortunate because we might share the same motivations, but it would be difficult for them to take on the additional expense and the additional investment to run the business the way that we might all agree would be the better way to do it.
All right. So let's talk about your customers for a second. That's the, kind of the other aspect that I was really interested in speaking to you about today, which is that, I mean, as I said before, there's green this and green that and sustainability everywhere you look now. People have to be, beware of greenwashing and all sorts of people that maybe are less moral about the whole idea and are just looking to kind of make a buck off people who are interested in mm-hmm. the environment. But the one thing that really that caught my eye and why I called you guys and rather than the other 400 times that I've seen someone saying that they used Bullfrog Power, was that it really, it wasn't an end note at the side of the, at the side of the bill. You really, like as I said at the beginning of the interview, there's a gigantic plaque when you walk in the door. It's really front and center. So clearly, aside from the feel-good aspect of it, from a business point of view, clearly you've banked on this being something that your customers are going to appreciate, which is something that's always an interesting conversation here in Canada because there's, this idea of environmental Canadianism has been mentioned several times as being kind of a mile wide and an inch deep, which, and so I'm just like, am I misreading it to say that you're confident that Canadian customers really do care about these issues?
Yes, we believe that to be true. We do it because we think it's the right choice for the business. It makes us and the people who work in our restaurants feel better about it. But one of my children actually works in one of our restaurants, and he says that the customers who may ask him about Bullfrog, it's a good example, they may not understand what it is. If he gets to explain it to someone, they go, oh, that's really interesting. I like that. Good choice. It does motivate them. It's not going to bring you into anybody's business unless the product you're buying is good. So in our case, the food has to taste great.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid actually that is actually all the time we have for today, but I really do appreciate you joining us. Again, that was Warren Price, the Executive Vice President for So Street Burger Company and New York Fries. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks, Darren. Been fun.
All right. Have a great day.
Take care.
We're going to have another quick music break, and Liam O'Doherty, our friend from Taking It Global, is going to jump on the line and tell us a little bit about one of the projects they've got coming up. So stay tuned for this quick music break, and we'll be right back to wrap up the program. And we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority, just wrapping up the program here. We've got good friend Liam O'Doherty from our good friends over at Taking It Global. Lots of good friends all around. How are you doing today, Liam?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning. So you were telling me earlier about some project that's going to be going on really soon that sounded neat. I thought our listeners might be interested. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about the conference that's coming up next week.
Absolutely. I'm just about to head to the Civicus World Assembly, which is a conference that's happening in Montreal next week, where civil society from all around the world is kind of gathering to discuss topics that are of interest to them and how we can kind of redefine the global governance system and redefine how NGOs work together to be more effective at protecting the environment and upholding human rights and just changing the way the systems that govern our planet work.
And so one of the focuses that had been mentioned there, of course, is media and new media and that sort of thing. How do you think that plays into this whole global conversation?
Well, it completely changes the whole conversation, right? We haven't had, up until this point, the type of feedback loop, so the ability to very quickly broadcast messages and crowdsource information or even crowdsource funding for our own kind of NGOs and initiatives. And with all these new technologies and new kind of toys, they really in some ways change the game for these NGOs. And so we're really kind of exploring and figuring out the different best practices and ways that some people have really been able to use these technologies very effectively that can then spread across the sector and across the globe and affect more change more quickly.
And so one of the things you said there kind of jumped out at me. When we're talking about crowdsourcing funding, for instance, we've talked on the program quite a bit over the last half year about the Harper government's route to perhaps, you know, in the view of environmentalists, at least intimidate NGOs in view of maybe some others, maybe some legitimate questions around international funding and about kind of external corruption, almost as they put it, you know, external outside influence subverting our national interests. How do you feel about that issue? What about the issue of external funding and other people from other countries sort of affecting our political system? Is that a valid concern for Canadians?
I think it is, but not when it comes to NGOs. I mean, NGOs themselves don't have enough funding to really be, you know, affecting the change that we want. That's kind of the problem and why we have been turning to crowdsourcing and these new methods. I think more interesting and the more kind of what we should be looking at a little bit more carefully is how external funds are actually, you know, affecting government policy in terms of oil and gas companies and how that might affect the political system in ways that we're not aware of as much.
I think that's a really valid kind of way to put it. I mean, when we're talking about money exchange being kind of if you exchange the word, you know, money for influence and kind of think about it that way, you know, the oil industry, for instance, among many others, multinational corporations in general, kind of are essentially, you know, having influence over our government on a daily basis. Is there a difference there between, you know, an oil contract and someone from Uganda sending Canadian NGO money?
There is, in that the oil contract is probably infinitely more money than people from Uganda would be able to send. Yeah.
Okay, so I mean that kind of affects one part of that, and the other aspect is as far as like crowdsourcing international ideas. I mean, one of the things that I kind of like to bring up when that conversation gets going is the idea that when we're talking about stuff having to do with the environment as opposed to other political issues, is that these issues are kind of by definition international global issues. There really isn't a way to deal with them on a isolated, siloed kind of country by country basis. So they almost require global input, because the things we do here in Canada affect the people, like actually do directly affect the people who are interested. So it's not like, you know, somebody in another country trying to talk about a local urban issue and trying to, you know, affect our bike lanes or something like that from a city planning perspective. They're interested in bike lanes because they're worried about carbon, which actually does directly affect them.
Yeah, absolutely. The environment doesn't respect national borders.
Yeah. And so what are your hopes for this conference? What should we be looking for to come out of it?
Well, I'm, again, really hoping to connect with amazing young people around the world and learn from what they're doing and what they've been able to implement. The other thing that I'm really excited about talking about and kind of exchanging ideas around is this iOS Mac app that we've recently developed called Commit to Act. And it's basically, it creates a community of practice around environmental behaviors so that you who are taking a specific action, let's say riding your bike to work, can see that other people around the world are doing similar things and can kind of be reinforced and comment and make pictures and kind of provide evidence of the different actions that you're taking, so that we don't feel as isolated in the kind of little steps that we're taking towards a better world.
Okay, and then finally now with the just like last minute or so that we've got here, we've been talking a lot for the past few weeks about Bill C-38. We've had a wide variety of opinions and perspectives on the program, ranging from super freaked out and, you know, the sky is falling, all the way down to, you know, we don't really know what's happening yet. A lot of these edits are potentially valid, so maybe, you know, we'll have to stay tuned to see what happens, but for the time being, kind of nothing super major that Canadians should be upset about has happened. Where do you fall along that spectrum? How worried about the implications of C-38 are you?
I'm more interested in what we can do about it and how we can, you know, engage with the political system to say, I'm not sure that this actually suits our needs, and this is something that is good for us, and that it's a cause for more kind of scrutiny of the actual system itself, and that it's something we should be not kind of putting aside, but should be kind of putting the spotlight on and figuring out exactly how it might affect us in the future.
My little joke at the beginning of the program about potentially the next time getting pulled over by a police officer saying, you know, don't bother arresting me because it's just paperwork. I mean, is that, am I going a little bit too far with that one? Do you feel that it's corruption or criminal, or these sorts of words, are those words too intense at this point to be, as far as talking about making special exceptions for big business, or is this just a little bit of maybe hysteria on the part of some of the environmental groups?
I mean, it's always interesting to see how these laws actually shake down when they're put into practice. I'd like to kind of gather more information and evidence about how it's actually being enforced before really jumping the gun. But at the same time, those types of strong language really help to put the spotlight on things so that people's attention and scrutiny are kind of actively engaged on this issue.
Yeah, and I think the takeaway point there is that, you know, you and several of the people we've asked about this have said, yes, you know, I kind of need more information before we can really find out. And that's kind of the point, was that, I mean, this has all already gone through, and virtually nobody even really understands how these laws are going to be actually applied and what the actual effects of them are going to be. The government's insisting that it's just saving paperwork, and there's no kind of clear message about, does that mean they're just throwing out saving paperwork means not doing assessments and not doing their jobs, essentially, or does that mean that they're actually just kind of cleaning it up, or does it balance in between the two? I think that's really the point. And that was, I think, the biggest thing that I was upset about was just the idea that this was sort of pushed through in the middle of the night, whether or not it's a legitimate piece of legislation and really does legitimately protect the needs and responsibilities and the environment for Canadians, was just that it was sort of, either way, it was sort of done without our knowledge and with very little information. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for the program today. Thanks so much for stopping by and saying hi, Liam.
Thanks, Darren.
We always like hearing from Taking It Global. Feel free to check out their website as well, which is TIG.org, if I'm not mistaken.
TIGweb.org.
All right. Thanks so much, Liam. That is all the time we have for today, however. So you've been listening to The Green Majority, in case you didn't catch it earlier in the program today. Technical production was by Rose Palmieri. Web hosting and bandwidth for our podcast is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript of our news headlines as soon as we get our website back up at greenmajority.ca. If you have an idea for an issue or a topic you'd love to learn about, or someone you think that we should interview, go ahead and send us an email at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. That's thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We love hearing from our listeners. You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all-environmental news hour, produced every week live at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto. I'm Darren Kaster, and thanks for listening.